You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
It is my immense pleasure to introduce to you our next keynote speaker, Dr. Kwame Anthony Appiah. Dr. Appiah is a professor of philosophy and law at New York University and the Lawrence S. Rockefeller University Professor of Philosophy and the University Center for Human Values Emeritus at Princeton University. He earned his BA and PhD from the University of Cambridge and has since taught at numerous renowned universities, including Yale, Cornell, Duke, Harvard, Princeton, and NYU. Appiah has published widely on literary and cultural studies with a focus on African and African-American culture, ethics, and identity, including his most recent book, The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity, published with Live Right Publishing in 2018. For his work, he has also received many awards, including the National Humanities Medal. His work on cosmopolitanism, identity, and heritage takes a nuanced and practical approach, embracing the particularities and challenges of living within a complicated social context. He also helps others understand and tackle everyday challenges through his advice column, The Ethicist, at New York Times. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Appiah.
So there's always this anxious moment when I, because I put my talk up here earlier, and I did that once at a gathering, and the person who introduced me, as she moved away, took my paper with her. So I arrived at the podium. with no text. So then I had to rush after her and try and recover it. Anyway, it's here. It's amazing. All right. I hope you will see what this has to do with markets and society, but let me start with a hint, which is that at the center of this paper is a set of questions about ways of thinking about property. The classical literature of Europe begins with a dispute over war spoils. Sing, muse, the rage of Achilles, the Iliad says at its start. But what enraged Achilles? The fact that Agamemnon took from him a young woman he had captured in battle, who was originally given to him as part of his prize, his war prize. So the disputes at the start of the Iliad are not about whether you may take goods and people captured in battle. Nobody doubts that. The question is who among the victors gets what. The English language still has many more than one word for these goods, including booty and spoils. Then there's predation, which comes from the Latin word for these spoils, praeda. The Greeks had the verb harpazo, to take as booty. And those of you who know German will be familiar with the German noun Kriegsbeute. The Torah and the Quran both discuss these questions. The Quran says, know that whatever spoils you take, one-fifth is for Allah and the Messenger. That's Muhammad, his close relatives, orphans, the poor, and needy travelers. So there's now a connection between war spoils and provision of welfare for the disadvantaged. Slightly surprising connection. The author of Deuteronomy would have approved of Achilles' prize, Briseis. When you go to war against your enemies, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife, says in Deuteronomy. The Chinese for loot is shan li pin. In my father's language, Asante Chui, there's a word for a war captive that makes him into property. We say wa fan domum. We have taken him, made him a war captive. And the word afadir, which is probably the best translation for booty in my father's language, literally just means something that is taken. My favorite global word is the Bengali one, which is up there, which most of you won't know is pronounced loot. The convention, in other words, was almost universal. I began with the Iliad, but the epic of Sundiata, or Sunjara, probably the most celebrated work of African oral literature, dating to the 13th century and telling of the establishment of the Mali Empire, is also the story of war spoils. After the famous Sundiata defeated his great enemy, a lavish festival takes place in which Sundiata's forces display their spoils, including newly enslaved war captives and the religious idols of their enemy. Over the centuries, the laws of war enshrined the legitimacy of war booty. There are rules, of course. Cicero's oration against Verres accused the Sicilian governor of looting for his own personal enrichment. But the concern was with personal corruption, not with the seizing of war spoils. Cicero had no doubt that Verres was allowed to take these things. He just wasn't allowed to take them for himself, which was the problem that Cicero discusses in the oration in Verum. Many of the great kings and emperors of Africa, as elsewhere, were constantly at war, sustaining their kingdoms with the pelf of conquest. To the victor go the spoils. Well, that's no longer a sentiment that anyone, I suppose, wishes to affirm. After the singular destruction of the Second World War, the 1954 Hague Convention introduced the idea of cultural property into international law. Because such cultural property was, as the preamble says, of great importance to the cultural heritage of every people, damage, I'm quoting again, to cultural property belonging to any people whatsoever means damage to the cultural heritage of all mankind. This language is, as you can hear, stirringly internationalist. And yet the concept of property, of ownership, stipulates that particular peoples, which in practice meant states, were entitled to specific things. In the new era, the claiming of treasures was to proceed through assertions of cultural patrimony, through this concept of cultural property, through the force of international conventions. And this was, I think, I expect you'll agree, in many respects, a heartening development. What's striking, though, is that the internationalist claims have fallen swiftly out of favor, routinely subordinated now to the property claims of modern states, many of which didn't exist when the objects that they're seeking were made. Growing ranks of critics, meanwhile, call for the decolonization of the museum, interweaving two kinds of considerations. First, that articles in museums may have been acquired through illegitimate means, theft, for example. And second, that cultural property inherently belongs to those whose heritage it is. For these critics, these two concerns are aligned. Objects from formerly colonized parts of the world, in their view, were seldom obtained fairly and should, by default, be repatriated, with Africa as a particular focus of concern. The Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa has devoted many millions of dollars to assisting civil society organizations and other institutions working, as they put it on their website, to return Africa's heritage to its rightful home. In a recent celebrated work, celebrated, that is, among those of us who read things about museums, sardonically entitled The Brutish Museums, Dan Hicks, the curator of world archaeology at the University of Oxford's Pitt's Rivers Museum, which displays that university's archaeology and anthropology collections, essentially calls for museums to purge themselves of anything collected in the colonial period. In particular, he calls for the return of all the Benin bronzes around the world to their rightful owner, whom he judges to be the Royal Court of Benin. Like many, he understands the decolonization of the museum as an unwinding, the unwinding of an appalling history of domination. Museum officials, often dragging their feet but sometimes rushing ahead, have increasingly agreed. Today, the hallways of our great North Atlantic museums echo with calls for repatriation and restitution. Curators in Germany, the United Kingdom, the United States, France, and elsewhere have made preparations to send back objects to their rightful owners. in France at the behest of President Macron. Felwine Sarr and Bénédicte Savoy, a Senegalese and a French intellectual, one's Senegalese, one's French, produced a 2018 report on the restitution of African cultural heritage. The appropriation of heritage, the much-discussed Sarr-Savoy report states, is, quote, a crime against peoples. It mentions the famous Brennan bronzes as an egregious victim of colonial depredation. Particular notice is also given to the saber of El Hajj Omar Tall, that's him, the founder of the Tukulor Empire in Mali. This saber being a war prize that was taken in the 1890s by the French and that repose for a long time since then in the Musée de l'Armée in Paris. When we gaze on these objects in museums, the report urges, we should remember the violence they trail. What history do we want to revisit, they ask. Concerns about provenance have expanded then into a critique of the Encyclopedic Museum as such. Inasmuch as museums are bound to display the cultural heritage of other peoples, they are, in Dan Hicks's view, embodiments of colonial violence. For Hicks, quote, scientific collection of natural history specimens, quote, ethnographic collecting, quote, and instances of barter, purchase, and commissioning are all booty by other names. Everything must be liberated. Noting that the Benin bronzes were made by the melting of metal, he says that the museum itself should be melted down and radically recast. The Sarr-Savoy report, too, is a critique of the Encyclopedic Museum. The problem arises, they say, and I'm quoting, when the museum no longer becomes the site for the affirmation of national identity, but conserves objects procured from somewhere else and assumes the right to speak about these. Now, I don't have any objection to calls to look closely at procedures of acquisition, and I'm certainly not here to take sides in the institutional struggle between the restitutionists and the retentionists in any particular case. But my professional inclination as a philosopher is to sort through the concepts through which these arguments are being waged. Between culture and property, I think there's a dangerous intersection, and the formal concept of cultural property has become entangled in competing stories about identity, origins, and ownership. Cultural property is now a movement as well as a category, and yet the idea, I think, turns out on closer inspection to contain buried contradictions that may be worth exploring, unearthing. First, though, a few words about heritage and identity. Everything in any museum, including the museum itself as a building and as an institution, can be viewed as somebody's heritage, connected to them through some us, some we. And when we are connected to someone through something through an us, we think of it as a member of that us. We think of it as, in some sense, ours. Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and Confucius's Analects are mine as a philosopher. Great Zimbabwe and the rock-cupped tombs in the Valley of the Kings are mine as an African. The United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence are mine as an American. The mausoleum of the Asante kings is mine as the son of an Asante father. Gloucester Cathedral is mine through my mother, an Englishwoman born in Gloucestershire, and mine too, as someone who was raised as an Anglican. At the same time, all these things are yours and mine, ours, as human beings. Heritage comes to you because you think of yourself as connected through some collectivity by way of some sort of connection. So the incredible multiplicity of heritage derives as much from the many we's we belong to as from the multifariousness of our modes of connection. As a philosopher, as an African, as an American, as an Anglican. And I think we go wrong to dissolve the particularity of our connections in the solvement of universality. Both matter, both the particularity and the universality. Notice, however, that in the globalized world we live in today, we are shaped not just by what has happened on the territories where we live, and not just by what was done by people who shared our national or ethnic or religious identity, but for good and ill by the whole interacting history of our species. All right, so let's go back to the Benin Empire and the works known as the Royal Bronzes. The term, I should caution, is a bit of a misnomer. The so-called bronzes include works of wood and ivory, but chiefly they consist of metal plaques and sculptures made of brass. And these remarkable brass works distill a fascinating history of transcultural, transnational, transcontinental interaction. Starting about 5 centuries ago, the Edo people established a markedly hierarchical empire known as Benin. So that's not the current where the current country of Benin is, but it's in Edo State in Nigeria. With the king, the Oba, that's the Yoruba word for a monarch, directly in control of trade and in personal possession of the highest value goods in the kingdom, leopard skins, ivory, and these bronzes. The empire was constantly waging war, and in time, a great source of its wealth was trading captives, human war spoils like Briseis in the Iliad, to the Portuguese, who were at that time the major players in the transatlantic slave trade. Recall that nearly 5 million enslaved Africans were shipped to the Portuguese colony of Brazil, 40 or 50% of the historical total of the Middle Passage. In 1514, the Oba actually sent an embassy to Europe aiming to expand trade with the Portuguese. And you'll notice that many of the Benin bronzes are depictions of Portuguese people, not of Edo people. Some evidently traders, some armed mercenaries who were Portuguese in the employ of the Oba of Benin. And that's because the Portuguese were themselves symbols of the king's own wealth, his wealth in people. They were viewed as valuable assets, just as his own fierce warriors were. And so we come to the part of the history that the discussion of the Benin bronzes tends to ignore. Many of the marvelous objects were literally made out of payments for the enslaved, because one main currency with which the kingdom was paid was a horseshoe-shaped item of currency made of copper, brass, or brass, often imported from Europe, called the manila. It's true that West Africans, including the Edo people of Benin, had an old tradition of lost wax sculpture using brass, but brass wasn't so easy to come by. And the reason that these Benin brass works were so plentiful, they numbered in the tens of thousands, is that those manilas were so plentiful. In short, if the Edo people in the Kingdom of Benin had not believed in the legitimate acquisition of property through conquest, they wouldn't have had the resources from which they made the famous Benin bronzes. The practice of war spoils gained them these bronzes. The same practice later took many of them away. There are masterworks in the British Museum from Asante, where I grew up, along with the Benin bronzes, which were similarly acquired in a punitive expedition, as the British called these things, led by the founder of the Boy Scouts, Robert Baden-Powell, in 1874. One of my favorite passages in Baden-Powell's account of the assault tells what happened when British troops entered the palace of the Asante king, the Asante Hini, and as Baden-Powell puts it in a marvelous passive voice, the work of collecting valuables and property was proceeded with. He went on, "Perhaps the most striking feature about it was that the work of collecting the treasures was entrusted to a company of British soldiers and was done most honestly and well, without a single case of looting. Here was a man with an armful of gold-hilted swords, there one with a box full of gold trinkets and rings, another with a spirit case full of bottles of brandy. Yet in no instance was there any attempt at looting." Now, to us, that distinction seems absurd, but Baden-Powell is just making the distinction that Cicero made long before between public and private taking. It wasn't that the stuff was being taken. That wasn't looting. It would have been looting if any of the soldiers had put anything in his own pockets, which some of them actually did, because some stuff appeared on the auction market in London that seems to have come from individual soldiers taking things. Not until the 1970s did an Asante king, an Asante Hini, my uncle as it happens, but he didn't ask my advice, request the return of this treasure. Why did a whole century elapse? Well, start with the fact that my Asante ancestors were themselves practitioners, avid practitioners in the matter of war booty. Inevitably, some of the items in the king's palace, when Baden-Powell arrived, were British, because this wasn't the first Anglo-Asante War. In the first Anglo-Asante War, which started in 1823, half a century earlier, in a territorial dispute, the Asante routed the Anglo forces and killed the British governor, forcing the British to withdraw to Sierra Leone. So that time, the spoils of war came into Asante hands from the British. And when the turnaround came in the 19th century later, the Asante Hinni no doubt was distraught, but he could hardly be outraged. So far, I've been discussing issues involving parties with plausible ancestral connection to the cultural property in question. Consider now one of the most famous objects of antiquity, now housed in the Louvre, the Code of Hammurabi, dating to around 1750 BCE. So it was excavated at the beginning of the 20th century, in 1901, from a site in southwestern Iran with the permission of the then authorities in that country. So the dig was legal and the export was legal in that place at that time. Yet, by the expansive logic of the Sarr-Savoy report, that leader could be considered implicated within the colonial process. So maybe the steel should be returned to Iran. But Hammurabi's code isn't part of Persian history. King Hammurabi reigned in the old Babylonian Empire in what's now Iraq. The steel ended up in an Elamite city in Iran because back in the 12th century BCE, it was seized as war booty. So who does it belong to? Whose heritage is it? What we find in the current discourse about heritage, I think, carousels among very many different models of ownership. One, of which the Benin and the Asante cases are exemplars, one involves descent groups, people connected through ancestry. The current king of Asante is descended from the king of Asante who lost the goods to Baden-Powell. The current, the 40th Oba of Benin is connected to the earlier Obas who's made and then lost the men in bronzes. Another model is just territorial. After all, plenty of artifacts have no real connection to a currently existing group. Think of all those, when you go to museums in Italy, you see Etruscan objects, but nobody today claims to be Etruscan, even though there must be people in Italy who are descended from the Etruscans. One of my favorite examples here involves the, there's the Code of Hammurabi, there you are. These are Nok sculptures. They're from the territory of Nigeria, but we don't know hardly anything about the society that created them, and nobody today says that they're Nok or has a claim to be so. So as in many cases that involve antiquities, we treat these objects as state property, a bit like mineral deposits belonging to the country where they left the ground. A third model, so there's ancestry, there's territory. A third model involves something like identity. You can argue that something has become your cultural heritage by the workings of time and proximity. This is an argument that the British sometimes make about the Elgin marbles. They've been in England for such a long time, they've become part of British culture. And many people in the world don't have much sympathy with that British argument, but consider now how Italians might feel about these objects, the many Egyptian obelisks in Rome. Some from the 19th dynasty of Egypt, about 2,000 years BCE, have been longer in Rome than they ever were in Egypt, even though they're 3,500 years old. So it might be a reasonable Roman view that plunder plus time equals heritage. Inevitably, of course, these three models can collide, and objects can be meaningful for different reasons to different people, as I already stressed when I talked about the connections between heritage and identity. Consider, as the French might want us to do, some of Napoleon's military regalia. Viewed as cultural property, they're obviously important to the French and their sense of their own history. But Waterloo was a huge deal for the British and their sense of their history. And when Wellington defeated Napoleon, he was pleased to take and engrave various of Napoleon's swords with the splendid words, "This sword was won by the Duke of Wellington." So you go back to France. Now consider another item of French heritage, a sword that Napoleon had at Austerlitz in 1805, perhaps his greatest victory. What happened to it? Well, his great-nephew, the son of Napoleon III, carried that sword into battle in 1879 in South Africa, hoping to prove his valor by joining the Anglo-Zulu forces, the Anglo forces in the Anglo-Zulu War. On an ill-advised patrol, he ran into a group of Zulu soldiers and lost both his life and his sword. Now, suppose the Zulu nation laid claim to it. After all, if this episode was important to the Zulu people, wouldn't they have a heritage claim on it? Or should they be obliged to repatriate it to the French? Perhaps you might think the Oba of Benin presents a more straightforward case. Here we have the legitimate successor to an old line of kings laying claim to what had been possessions of his predecessor's palace. And the 40th Oba of Benin, Ewari II, has certainly continued many palace traditions, including the ownership of many high-value items. For example, on his enthronement in 2015, he came into possession of a customized Rolls-Royce Phantom 7 worth $500,000, adorned with a vast gold medallion on the front. Honoring tradition too, the Oba of Benin has not apologized, so far as I'm aware, for the kingdom's participation in the slave trade, unlike some other African customary rulers. Some years ago, when Nigeria's then President Buhari took possession of a couple of Benin bronzes, repatriated by two, no doubt well-intentioned, if in my view confused, British universities, he notably characterized them in the language, not of heritage, but of the marketplace. The president referred to them as high-priced objects. They were returned in a ceremony to Ewari II. A few days later, after the bronzes were repatriated, the Oba made his way in the Phantom 7 to pay a visit to General Obasanjo, the former Nigerian head of state and billionaire. And what did the Oba bring the general as a gift? Some royal Benin bronzes. Now, the general has nothing to do with Edo State. This is not his cultural heritage. He doesn't come from there. It's actually disputed where he does come from. But if cultural property is indeed property, why shouldn't the Oba make a present of his own treasures? Egyptian heads of state, from Muhammad Ali in the 19th century to Presidents Nasser and Sadat, routinely gave ancient Egyptian artifacts to foreign dignitaries. Yet many contemporary theorists of heritage don't think that they were entitled to do so. According to this account of heritage, cultural property isn't like other forms of property. You can't alienate it. You can't give, sell, or transfer it. You possess it in the way you possess your ancestry, which you can't unpossess either. Something like this model explains why the Church of England is returning a Benin bronze that was a gift in 1982, not in the colonial period, unless you believe that something about Nigeria that most Nigerians don't, from someone who was both the traditional Edo chief and the elected governor of the state whose capital, Benin City, is the Edo capital. On this account of cultural property, there are no procedures or conditions that made this transfer permissible, despite the fact that the person who did it had both traditional and democratic legitimacy in that place. And now we run into another quandary. Our concept of cultural property in the 20th century is the 20th century invention of Western lawyers, Western trained lawyers. So why should the Oba embrace this concept? It's tempting to suggest that he's happy to because it's working to his advantage, but why? It is tempting to suggest here that the colonial enterprise that we should focus on is a conceptual one rather than a material one, that what's going on is the colonization of the world by a concept invented by some European and American lawyers. In his book's discussion of the Benin bronzes, the Oxford curator of world archaeology supposes that once returned to the Oba, the items will be displayed in the Benin City Museum that the wonderful Anglo-Ghanaian architect, Sir David Adjaye, has been asked to design by the governor of Edo State, so not by the king. He omits to mention that the Oba objects to that museum and to the idea that the governor, the democratically elected head of the state in which he lives, should have any role in the disposition of these objects. And President Buhari, who just stopped being president of Nigeria, apparently shares this view, since one of his last acts as Nigerian president was to declare that all Benin bronzes belong to the Oba, blindsiding the National Commission for Museums and Monuments, which has been managing negotiations so far. I'm not sure whether it's possible under the Nigerian constitution for the president to declare something to be somebody's property. I suspect that there's property law in Nigeria. As we've seen, one model of cultural heritage directs the return of these bronzes to the unrepentant heir of a slaving empire to be displayed or gifted at the discretion of the royal court. Another insists that their possession is inalienable. And a third idea, which isn't normally mentioned in these discussions, which is the idea of reparative justice, reminds us that these objects were crafted from human plunder and asks us to think about the human victims who have no bejeweled leader to press their claims. Does the concept of cultural property really help us sort through these questions? As various UNESCO documents remind us, cultural heritage includes intangibles, ceremonies, rites, rituals, social practices. Among these age-old practices is the taking of war spoils. But if war spoils have a long history, so does repatriation. The task of humanists is to remind you that everything that's going on now has been done a million times before. After the Second Punic War in 2001 BCE, the Roman general Scipio Africanus, alas, that isn't really a bust of Scipio Africanus, but it was lived for a long time in a museum in Naples as a bust of Scipio Africanus, and I like it, so I'm using it to remind you of Scipio Africanus. It's actually, interestingly enough, an Egyptian priest. But after Scipio Africanus defeated Hannibal and gained control, there you see Hannibal's elephants, and gained control of Carthage, the Carthaginian spoils were, of course, sent back to the were sent back not to Rome, but to the Greek cities in Sicily from which they had been taken. As a canny imperialist, Scipio was positioning himself as a pious protector of these Hellenic communities. And so with Octavian, the founder of the Roman Empire, after his forces defeated Antony and Cleopatra, Egypt was pillaged, of course, war spoils. But the man who became Caesar Augustus hewed to a policy of repatriating artworks that Antony and Cleopatra had plundered from cities in Asia Minor. So again, they didn't take them back to Rome. He sent them back as a goodwill gesture to the places that they had come from to Egypt. Because he knew that in maintaining an empire, goodwill is a valuable political asset. He also knew that these works were far more meaningful to those communities than they were to him or to Rome, and not simply out of a sense of property rights. As Scipio and Octavian already understood, though they wouldn't have used language like this, identity mattered. And yet to recognize that identity is genuinely important when it comes to the way we relate to objects doesn't mean that we should equate identity with ownership. For one thing, African artisans, like artisans in every continent, and African artists, have always created objects that were meant to be traded. Creativity and commerce are not separate. Think, for instance, of the famous Afro-Portuguese ivories. These items were made by African artists for the Portuguese, that's what makes them Afro-Portuguese, who sometimes sold them on. Albrecht Dürer, whom you may have heard of, purchased some of them. These were commissioned objects, not intended for use in the place where they were made. They might have been traded on unfavorable terms, I suppose. So why not return them to the Kingdom of Benin? We're left reconciling our ideals of justice
to the prospect of further enriching predatory elites or their progeny. The issue of wrongful or exploitative trade has to be taken seriously, of course. In the Savoy report, we're told about a French ethnographic expedition that led to the collection of, among other things, pre-Islamic Dogon religious artifacts from Mali. Now, we know a great deal about this expedition because the great French writer Michel Léris was a member of it. He kept extensive notes, and he published a vast book known in English as Phantom Africa, L'Afrique Fantôme, about that journey. And what we learn in that book, which for some reason was only recently translated into English, is that some items were acquired through chicanery and theft and extortion, but we also learn that after bargaining, many items were sold at a price agreeable to both parties in the exchange. We learn that still other objects which were desired by Marcel Griol, who led the expedition, were not obtained because a village chief held out, either because he wanted to keep it or because he didn't think the price was good enough. Léris, who writes about his French colleagues with withering contempt, was rather appalled by the episodes of pilfering, but he concedes that outright theft was in fact rare. In the majority of instances, what Léris sardonically called boutin, booty, seems to have been acquired for an agreed price from people who were entitled to sell it. So you might think that such objects, many of which ended up in the, many of which ended up in the Musée du Quai Branly in Paris, can continue to serve the function that Léris hoped they would serve, reducing ethnocentric prejudices by making the civilizations of Africa intelligible to Europeans. As I just indicated, Léris's account is deeply misanthropic. And so he depicted many of the African priests and rulers he encounters as duplicitous and manipulative as well. But it's to his credit that he didn't see them the way they're often depicted today, as credulous innocents capable only of being cheated and never capable of getting the better end of a deal. That's presumably what's implied by the thought that any transaction that occurred in the colonial period should be undone. We should be mindful, too, that as the Malian countryside has become more conventionally Islamic in the generations since then, many of these Dogon so-called fetishes were destroyed. It was a sign that you had given up the superstitions of your ancestors and fully embraced the world of the Muslim Ummah, the world of the Muslim faithful. Just in the past decade, in parts of Mali that have fallen under the control of Salafi insurgents, even Sufi shrines and tombs have often been destroyed for being insufficiently Islamic. You could imagine what they do with pre-Islamic stuff. But then iconoclasm, the destruction of objects that offend our piety, is another deeply entrenched human practice. The Hague Convention be damned. These are all instances of European iconoclasm. This is why UNESCO treaties meant to preserve heritage, here a thing for markets and society people to think about, institutions having perverse effects, contrary to their intention. In the late 1990s, you'll recall, hardliners in the Taliban regime in Afghanistan were noisily calling for the destruction of figurative pre-Islamic objects. Afghan curators in Afghanistan's National Museum, sent out feelers to people in institutions elsewhere, and a deal was in fact made to crate up endangered artifacts from the museum and move them to Switzerland for temporary safekeeping. But as a UNESCO signatory, the Swiss needed UNESCO approval of the transfer, and UNESCO officials refused because they were objecting to the movement of cultural antiquities from their country of origin. Staff members at the museum have described what happened next. They were ordered to open drawers of antiquities by Taliban inspectors in the wake of Mullah Omar's February 2001 edict against pre-Islamic art. So here were drawers of extraordinary Bactrian artifacts and Gandhara heads and figurines, and the Taliban inspectors methodically opened the drawers, took out mallets, and pulverized their contents. I've spoken of how we relate to objects through our identities, but identities can motivate us to demolish objects as well as to preserve them. I want to go back now to Sheikh Omar Saidu Tal, the hero of the Sar Savoy story, and to take up their invitation to ask historical questions that they don't ask. Who was he, Omar Tal? In the middle of the 19th century, he built a vast Muslim empire, the Tukulor Empire, mostly in what's now Mali, devoted to slaving, war booty, and the religious and physical destruction of paganism and its relics. His great call was to convert pagan Africans to Islam, often forcibly, and he conducted his jihad with extraordinary resourcefulness, trailing a notable contingent of enslaved Hausa people. His soldiers toppled the mighty Segu Empire of the Bambara, entering its capital in 1861, sacking the palace, and arranging for a very public burning of Segu's so-called fetishes. From our perspective, that is to say, Omar Tal ranked among his proudest achievements the wholesale destruction of what we are now pleased to call cultural property. What history do we want to revisit indeed? None of this appears in the Sar Savoy report, and why should it? Since cultural heritage encompasses identity-related practices, iconoclasm, the concerted destruction of cultural heritage, is itself a cultural heritage. Inasmuch as the Dakar-Djibouti expedition of Léris kept objects from being destroyed, it was obstructing another expression of heritage. In the wake of the Sar Savoy report, France did return the Omar Tal saber. A public ceremony was held in Dakar, in which France's prime minister handed the saber to Senegal's president. At least a symbolism, it looked like a step forward towards the restitution that the report had demanded. But why Senegal? Although the object is called Omar Tal's saber, it actually belonged to his son Amadou and was seized from him by the French in 1893 after he was defeated in battle in Mali, not in Senegal. The French took it as a war prize in Mali. Now, Amadou was the ruler of the eastern regions of what had been the Segu Empire. He wasn't a resident of what today is Senegal at all. His palace was in Segu Sikoro on the Niger River. That's about 1,400 miles, kilometers from Dakar. So whose heritage is it? Well, here's where national narratives come into play. Many people in Mali regarded Omar Tal as an invader who presided over carnage, destruction, and disorder, and brought the ideal of an Islamic state into bad repute. But in Senegal, Omar Tal, born on a village along the border between Senegal and Mauritania, is seen as a vision of triumphant eastward imperial conquest. And they nurture a somewhat spurious notion of him as an anti-colonialist. A fictive but stirring narrative connects Senegal to the saber, and that's why it ended up there, not in the place that it was made and used. Now, identities almost always subsist on fictional narratives, but to give them authority in arguments over cultural property, you end up with a good deal of history that you must not revisit. A final detail, the blade was a French manufacture, which is to say that the blade probably originated in war spoils from the other direction. But of course, as I've been suggesting, the seizing of booty itself is one of those intangibles, those practices that you might think should be covered by the expression cultural heritage. Okay, the thought I want to encourage is that a unitary idea of property in which something is either mine or thine ultimately betrays a usable idea of heritage. If something qualifies as heritage, I say, with the Hague Convention, it must be the heritage of humankind as well. And so you can't exclude the global constituency from consideration in deciding on its disposition. From this cosmopolitan perspective, we should care about access for all, but we should also care about accuracy. When it comes to museum practices, intimacy does not always serve understanding. The Museum of Islamic Art in Doha has voluminous holdings spanning 13 centuries, It provides scholarly context. The building is lovely, designed, by the way, by an architect who was raised by a Buddhist mother, and the conditions are superb. I am happy that it exists. I have enjoyed going there. An Islamic museum within an Islamic polity has advantages beyond self-affirmation. But it has limitations too. The museum cannot acknowledge easily the plurality of faith traditions within Islam because it cannot treat Islam simply as a historical phenomenon. It cannot provide the full historical context that secular scholarship might. There is one Ummah and one truth. It would not do to talk about this school or that faction beyond those recognized in our tradition. Now, there's much that can be seen and said in this museum, but there is much that cannot be brought into view. If all Islamic art were presented under clerical supervision, the loss would be real. But is this not true, mutatis mutandis, of the Benin bronzes? Germany is set to return 1,100 bronzes to Nigeria. Cultural patrimonialists hope that all the bronzes will be returned. If the Edo governor ultimately triumphs over the King of Benin and that Adje Museum is built, I'll be thrilled to visit it. But I'd worry if the Benin Royal Palace, whose incumbent remains unrepentant about slavery, gets to police all the placards. My point is that to take restitution seriously, we must not rely upon the overly selective, one might say curated histories, enemies of the encyclopedic museum often purvey. Hegel, notoriously, declared that Africa was excluded from history. In polemics about the Bruges museums, alas, history is something that Europeans visited upon Africa. They lose sight of the reality that Africa has its own history, irreducible to the depredations of European power. In the world in which I grew up, Africans had history because Africans had agency. One of my names is Akramampim. The first Akramampim was a fierce 18th century Asante general, my ancestor, and the villagers in the village he founded remember his exploits in detail. And I'm actually a chief of that village. Many of them descended, however, from Akramampim's war captives. So we cannot discuss how he came by his Manilas. This history isn't a two-dimensional history of European dominators and the African dominated, and it can't be unwound as the curator, the Oxford curator of antiquities, would like. Now, the Encyclopedic Museum, too, has a history. It has been implicated in the very best and the very worst of what human beings do. But its counter-cosmopolitan critics, conflating universality with imperialism, would make these institutions more parochial, less humanly expansive, less diverse, and all in the name of an incoherent and parochial concept of cultural property. I offer no simple solutions when it comes to the circulation of culturally significant objects. I don't think a single heuristic suffices. As I've argued, our models of heritage generate clashing claims. And the values enshrined by museums, too, are multiple, not singular. Think back to the Asante Hine's Royal Museum, the Aban, in the 19th century Kumasi, the one that was raided by the British. It wasn't a mere storehouse of Asante heritage. The collection that was raided by the British included books in many languages, European clocks, silver plate, Persian carpets, paintings and engravings and chests, Arabic scimitars, Damask curtains, and Moorish handicraft. I'm quoting from an account by the journalist for the Illustrated London News who was there, and more. Some of this was war booty, but what's striking is that the Asante Hine, who built this place, was evidently impressed by what he had heard about the British Museum. And he set out to create a comparably cosmopolitan collection. Ideologues of cultural property think that when his treasures were taken, the affront was the loss of local heritage, the work of local artisans. But for those who built the museum in Kumasi, the greater loss was the loss of artifacts from elsewhere in the world. Those were harder to replace. Indeed, European and North American museums, with their vast collections in storage, might consider lending European art to African institutions. We have a lot of Asante objects in Asante already, and I'm glad of it. One of my favorite museums, these are the sorts of things that were in that Asante collection. One of my favorite museums is this one, which was, when I was growing up, the home of Otumfuo Osei Ajaman Prempeh II, King of Asante, my great uncle, who we used to visit there after church on Sundays. Why not send there the kind of work that we don't have or regularly see? How about, that's my great uncle, how about a Piero della Francesca? How about a Benin bronze? How about some Ming China? How about a Mayan relief? For that matter, why don't we in Asante send back some of the war spoils that we seized from the British? One of the many symbols that recurs regularly in Asante iconography is a little bird with its head turned back to pick at the feathers between its wings, a bird called Sankofa, which means literally, go back and get. There's a tree proverb associated with this figure that says, Utu Trini, Nau Sankofa, Yen Chi. If you throw something away and you go back and fetch it, that is not taboo to us. The proverb can be used to say, of course, that it is good to retrieve what you need from the past. I think we all understand that feeling, the connection people feel to cultural objects that are symbolically theirs because they were produced, for example, from within a world of meaning created by their ancestors. The connection to art through identity is powerful and should be acknowledged. But the cosmopolitan in me wants to remind us of the connections we can have not through identity, but despite difference. Museums show us what we can do, what we have done. They show us the attainments of our various kinds, and they show us the attainment of humankind. It would be a terrible loss if blinkered notions about cultural property encouraged these encyclopedic institutions to narrow their horizons. In short, the time has come to recognize the Encyclopedic Museum itself as part of global cultural heritage, worthy of being prized, sustained, and protected. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.